So this course will be cosmology review. It will be taught by two people, me and Kurt over there. But before we actually jump into that, let me mention at least three reasons why you should be interested in cosmology. So why cosmology? And so the first reason is that the physics is very rich. So basically the cosmology combines various subjects. It combines statistical physics, it combines general relativity, combines quantum field theory, particle physics. So all these things are combined together. So it's very rich physics. Also, because it's so rich and so still new discoveries are being done, it's likely that while studying cosmology, you will discover new physics. So new physics. Things likely to be discovered here. And finally, combining the previous two reasons, there's lots of jobs on the market. So if you study cosmology, you are likely to get a nice position somewhere. This is not so true, for example, if you study gravitational physics, much less positions. Okay, so by the way, let me just mention a famous quote by Zeldovich, who was one of the Russian geniuses. And so he quoted that the early universe is an accelerator for the poor. Okay, so really our LHC can go all the way up to 10 TeV, whatever. But in early universe, you go to energies much higher. Of course, the question is whether you can observe anything out of that. But it's definitely true, and perhaps there are some new things to be. So early universe is an accelerator for the poor. I really like this quote. So now I gave you all these handouts, but let me briefly mention the plan. And as I said, there are two lectures. So I'll do the simple stuff at the beginning, and then everything fancy and more difficult will be after Kurt. Okay, so I'll do homogeneous universe. And by that I mean, well, I will discuss, just as a preparation for Friedmann, Robinson, Volcker space, I'll discuss homogeneous spaces, so maximally symmetric spaces, only symmetric spaces. And then the following two lectures will be about FRW space. W space time, you probably heard about it from Neil already. So basically I will repeat what you learned and perhaps tell you something a little bit more, but not too much. So I will discuss kinematics and dynamics. The second part of the course will be about matter, content of the universe. And in order to discuss this, you will need to know something about thermodynamics in expanding universe. So I'll review that. So thermodynamics in expanding universe. And I'll be cheating. So really to describe what's happening in the early universe or later on, you need to use full kinetic theory, Boltzmann equation and stuff like that. I will not do that. I'll just use the equilibrium thermodynamics just to simplify our lives and give you the flavor of what's going on. And then I will discuss nuclear synthesis. And cosmic microwave background very, very briefly. And again, I will leave this Picard, so he will have the full lecture about cosmic microwave background. And then I'll tell you a little bit about dark matter and dark energy. And hopefully, if I have time, I'll finish with three puzzles, which will tease you until Kurt will resolve them for you. And then the third part will be about fluctuations. And as I said, this will be the fancy part. So you will be discussing CMB power spectrum. So CMB again, but now the anisotropies in CMB and then really to understand. So there are various peaks there and so on. So this will be discussed. Here, you will discuss inflation and you know various perturbations and structure formation. And many other interesting things. So this will be really the advanced, nice stuff. And so I gave you some additional reading. I mentioned three books over there. My favorite one is actually Dodelson. So I think Dodelson, it's called Modern Cosmology. But unfortunately, there's only a few copies in the library, but you don't really need that book. So the course will be self-contained. So only if you read, you know, additional reading, then turn to this one. Okay, questions to this? Questions? So let me just start with the homogeneous universe then. So part one. Is the homogeneous universe. One more thing, so that there's no confusion, there will be three homeworks and six tutorials. So three homeworks, not two. Okay, so historically, there is something which is called Copernicus or a cosmological principle. And that basically says that we don't have any privileged space, any privileged position in the universe. Copernicus principle or cosmological principle. Principle. And so it's really that our position is not unique in the universe. So now what we observe is that it's tremendous isotropy. So no matter which direction we look at the universe, it basically, on large scales, it looks the same. Okay, so we observe isotropy. That means in any direction, we see the same thing. If this isotropy is observed by any observer in the universe, that's called global isotropy, then it implies that the universe is also homogeneous, meaning that it looks the same from any position in the universe. So, but basically, that's something which we cannot really prove. It depends on this principle. Right? So we can really verify the isotropy, but we cannot verify. We cannot travel all the way to Alpha Centauri and look at the universe from there and then see, okay, is the universe, does it look the same from there? Okay, so observable. So if I use this thing, so plus whatever stands here, then I have homogeneous universe. Homogeneous universe means that it's invariant under translation. So of course, this homogeneity and isotropy, they are not valid on all scales. So they are valid only on certain scales. So definitely, if I take very, very small scales, then the universe is different inside me and here, right? So it's only in certain scales. So observable universe. Observable universe, something like 10 to the 4 megaparsecs. 10 to the 4 megaparsecs. And you observe this homogeneity. So homogeneity observed. Homogeneous is, let's say, at scales 100 megaparsecs. Okay, so this is the scale where you see the homogeneity. This is basically the observable universe. And it's not homogeneous on the small scales, or perhaps not even on the larger scales. Okay. So now, because the spatial slices of the universe are homogeneous and isotropic, such spaces are actually called maximally symmetric. So that's why, as a first part today, I will study maximally symmetric spaces. And that will prepare the ground for to study the Friedman-Robertson-Walk universe. So part A will be maximally symmetric spaces. And so these include, of course, Minkowski, but also Euclidean space. So they can have various signatures, they can have various curvatures, and so on. So you have Euclidean space, Minkowski space, and n dimensions, n-dimensional sphere, hyperboloid, but also spaces like De Sitter space or anti-De Sitter space. So these all spaces are actually maximally symmetric. And we can cover them all in very elegant construction. And that is that we actually embed these spaces in a higher dimensional space, in an auxiliary higher dimensional space. So elegant construction embed in n plus one dimensional space. And that will work uniformly for all of these cases. So let me start with the most familiar example to you, and that is of the sphere. And just to make life very simple, let's make just a two-dimensional sphere. So S2. So you know that you can talk about sphere, and you can imagine the sphere to be basically a hypersurface embedded in three-dimensional Euclidean space. So I have x1, x2, and x3, and it's something which is a constant radius rho. In the Euclidean space, so what it means is that in order to write the metric on the sphere, I just write the metric in that Euclidean space. So ds square is dx1 square plus dx2 square plus dx3 square. So that's my Euclidean space. And now I have the constraint, the hypersurface constraint, and that says that rho square is x1 square plus x2 square plus x3 square. Okay. So now I have to combine these two together. So the way how to do that is you differentiate this constraint. So from there you get that 0 equals to x1 dx1 plus x2 dx2 plus x3 dx3. This is not a good blackboard, but anyway. So from here, I can write that dx3. And let me make, okay. So dx3 is x1, dx1, plus x2, dx2, over x3. So x3 from this, again, is rho square minus x1 square minus x2 square. So that's x3 square. So let's make it square, the whole thing. And this is precisely what we need. And so if you shuffle, well, if you plug this guy here into your metric, then it all depends only on two coordinates. So it's really two surface, and that's what we wanted. So this would be the metric written for the sphere written in Cartesian coordinates, quasi-Cartesian coordinates. You can also, if you want to, you can also change spherical coordinates. Spherical coordinates, and they are given as usual. So rho sine theta cos phi, and x2 is rho times sine theta sine phi, and x3 is rho cosine theta. And then that metric would look much nicer. So I need to plug this guy here, and it's relatively ugly. But if I use these coordinates, then the metric is very simple. So d square is just rho square d theta square sine square theta d phi square. Okay. So this was all very trivial, but I just wanted to repeat this. Okay, so let me do another example slightly more quickly. It's something which may not be that familiar. So if you want to study H2, then the construction is very, very similar as studying S2. You just shuffle some signs. So first change you make, so shuffle. Signs. So first change which you make is that you change from the Euclidean space of your embedding to the Minkowski space. Okay, so consider Minkowski. So now your metric element is ds square plus dx1 square plus dx2 square minus dx3 square. So this guy will play the role of the time. And so here we had a plus sign here, which meant that we have positive curvature space. So now we change to minus sign. So it will be negative curvature space, negative curvature. And that means that we choose a minus sign in front of rho square. It's minus rho square. And then we use the same signature as for the space. So this will be now H2. So again, the same procedure. You take the differential of this equation here, and you shuffle it here. So how does it look like? So now we are in Minkowski space. So X3 is something like time, right? And it's a hyperboloid in that. So we have a light cone here. And the question is whether it's inside like that, whether it's two-sheet hyperboloid, or whether it's outside. So now, when you have negative curvature, it's actually inside here. So it's this thing. And this would be your role. So now, question is about the final signature, right? So we started with Minkowski, and maybe we put some hypersurface. So now, is this space actually Euclidean or Lorentzian? So now, from this construction, you see that the whole it's the surface of this hyperboloid, and it's inside the light cone. That means that it's actually space-like everywhere. So if it were the other one, if it were this one here, it would be time-like, and that would be Lorentzian. However, this one is actually space-like. So we have two-sheet hyperboloid, and it's embedded in Minkowski space. In Minkowski space within the light cone, and that means that it's, the induced metric is Euclidean. you probably had induced metric, right? So this is my metric for the for this auxiliary space. But once I actually take into account the constraint, then I have induced metric in that. So once I shuffle this guy here. Questions? So now, this was almost the most general construction. So more generally, so I'll be interested in n-dimensional maximally symmetric space. And so I can start with a signature, which is an arbitrary signature. So there I had an Euclidean signature for the metric. Here I have Minkowski signature. In general, I have signature. So it's n dimensions. I'll consider n dimensions. And then signature P and Q. That's for the embedding space. Well, more or less. And then you can also have curvature. And there will always be rho square, but it depends on the sign in front of that rho square. And that's parameterized by a discrete parameter k, which can be plus, minus 1, or 0. So plus 1, minus 1, or 0. And the construction is precisely as we did it before. So my metric in that auxiliary space is ds square. Now I take an arbitrary diagonal metric and a Minkowski metric, but with signature P and Q. TXP. And then if K is not equal to 0, then I add DXN plus 1. Okay. So this is my embedding metric. Okay. And you can define this to be big eta AB. I will just mention what I mean by that. DXA, DXB, and this is PQ and K. And the hypersurface, so the hypersurface surface will be so. K, of course, if k is equal to 0, this term is gone, and I don't have to do anything. There is no additional constraint. I just have Minkowski space. But if k is not equal to 0, then I have this hypersurface constraint. And that will be k times rho square equals to now the same metric, eta ab pq k xa. So now, of course, here I use some notation. So this small a and b indices, they run from 1 to n. So a goes 1 to n. And these big indices, a and b, b and a, go from 1 to n plus 1. So now, one more notation is actually useful, and that is how you raise the indices with these indices, how you raise these indices or lower these indices. And that is, so I'll define small xa to be eta ab through that small metric, ab, eta ab, pq, and xb. And then you can define x square to be xa. XA. And of course, the metric eta AB, eta AB is diagonal metric, which has plus, and minus, and this will be P of those and Q of those. So far, so good? Okay. So now let's solve that and then write down really the most general metric you can write down. So we have that k rho square equals to, now in our new notation, it will be just x square plus k x n plus 1 square. Okay. So now if I differentiate this guy, so from here I get that k x n plus 1 d x n plus 1 equals to minus x a dx a, right? That's what it is. Rho is just a constant, k is just a constant. So in other words, I want to solve for this guy. And remember, so this is only valid when k is not equal to 0, but k is plus minus 1. So if I multiply by k, I can always multiply by k, but if I have k squared, it's 1. Okay, so from here, you have that dxn plus 1 square is xa dxa square divided by rho square minus k x square. So now you plug it to the first equation, and we have the result, which is, you know, we solve something nice and interesting. So GAB PQ MK. So we plug this guy into the first equation. So that will be eta AB plus whatever we got here. But of course, now I have to expand this bracket here. So it'll be XA, XB, and there'll be DXA, DXB, and so on, right? So this guy is eta AB P and Q plus, and there's that K standing in front of DXN plus 1 square, so that K still has to be there. So it's K, XA, XB, and then this thing, rho square minus KX square. And so this is the metric for an arbitrary maximally symmetric space written in Cartesian coordinates. Okay. So now it will be your homework. You will suffer a lot for that, but so homework. One, but it's actually, it's not that difficult once you are using some tricks and this very powerful notation. So your task will be to derive actually the Riemann tensor. And that's a lot of pain. So anyway, RABCD, if you know the result, it's much simpler. So it depends. So K is still there, rho square is still there. And now you have to respect all the symmetries. So it'll be G and G. And minus g and g. And so now we know that if you exchange c and d, it must have minus sign. And if you exchange a and b, it must have minus sign. And if you swap the two, you have to have plus signs. So it's basically a unique way how to do that up to a sign and b and c. Okay. So this is what you will derive in your homework. But it's actually very nice, because what it means is that if I write down, so this means that if you consider the Einstein equation, g mu plus lambda, now I switch notations, that's not too good. So GAB plus lambda GAB equals to 8 pi G Newton TAB. So this is my Einstein equations, where I actually allowed for this cosmological term that's allowed by symmetries. So you can always write it there. So now, for that, I need to calculate what Ricci tensor is. So I have to make some contraction, let's say A and C. I contract and I get a Ricci tensor out of that. And if you plug it on the left-hand side, what you find out is that, so this metric here, so solves Einstein equation. If you take TAB equals to zero, but lambda actually is non-trivial, and it's k times n minus 1, n minus 2, divided by 2 rho square. So maximally symmetric spaces, they solve, let's say, vacuum Einstein equations with cosmological constant. And so if k is positive, it will be positive cosmological constant. If k is negative, it's negative cosmological constant. And of course, if k is zero, then we are back to Minkowski. Okay. So that's nice. So now we already discussed the sphere, and we discussed the hyperboloid. So let me discuss the other cases very briefly and just make a table. So of course it depends on what K is and what this embedding space is. So I have k equal to 0, I have k equal to plus 1, and I have k equal to minus 1. And then the signature of my embedding space can be n0. So if it's n0, then of course this is just Euclidean space. This is the sphere which we discussed, and this will be the hyperboloid. So these spaces are especially interesting for cosmology because that's the part of the Friedman-Robertson-Walker space. So they can be also characterized, let's say, by a behavior of geodesics or whatever. So if you start in Euclidean space, these two parallel lines, they remain parallel all the time. If you start with the sphere, they actually meet at a finite time. They diverge in the hyperbolic space. Also, if you draw a triangle, then of course the degrees, so triangle here looks like that. So you have 180 degrees in total. Here it would have more than that, and here it would have less than that. Okay, so here, if I start with parallel lines, they remain parallel, they cross, or they diverge. Okay, so that's first interesting case. Now n minus 1 and 1. So then this is Minkowski. This is called De Sitter. And this is called anti-De Sitter. And then you can keep going, n minus 2 and 2 and so on. But the problem is these spaces over here is that you start with a space, is the embedding space, which has more time directions. So now here you have one time direction, here you have 2 and 3 and so on. And so if you start with spaces which have more time directions, they are usually bad. Right, so you have closed time-life curves, and so you have various problems. So these spaces actually are of interest for mathematicians, but not. So this is usually end of story for physics, and so there are problems. With time-life curves. So for example, a closed time-like curve is that you keep going forward in time, but at some point you meet the same line. So you are like circling in time or whatever. So usually when you have more times, then well, it happens when you have more times. Okay. So now let me draw the De Sitter space. So DS. It's again a hyperboloid, so similar to what we were drawing there, but now you embed that instead of in n and 0, embed it in n minus 1 and 1. So in the end, it looks slightly different. It's the other hyperboloid, actually. So if this is my thing, and so now x2 is something like time. And x1 is actually something like space. So you just plug it into that metric there. And I have a light cone here. So now is the outer thing. So this space has positive curvature, right? K is plus 1, so it has positive curvature. Because it is outside, it's time-like, so it's Lorentzian metric. So it's Lorentzian metric. So Lorentzian metric and positive curvature. So now if you want ADS space, all you do is basically you flip this on side. So in ADS, anyway, you can try to draw these things just using that metric there and the embedding. So now this is my X1. And this will be T, which is something like X2. Again, I have the light cone. And is the outer one. And x3 would be like towards u, but it would be another time. So now you know that you have n minus 1 and 1, but k is minus 1. So your embedding metric actually has two times now. So x2 and x3 will be times. So x3 is another time, t2, and this is space. So now you can always switch to different coordinates, and let's say that is the surface. Well, it's the surface of this hyperboloid. So I live on that surface. And you can always choose another coordinate which would go around that surface, let's say like that. But because it's in x2 direction and x3 direction, and they are both times, so this thing actually, if you choose this coordinate, it will be time coordinate. But you see that I can go around and in time. So this guy actually has closed time-like curves. Okay. So this thing would be an example of closed time-like curve. And so despite that, people are excited about ADS space, and they still use it a lot. But they go, let's say, for example, one solution how to avoid these closed time-like curves is that you go to a covering space, and basically you say, well, I start here, I go all the way here, but I'm not at the same point, but there's another hypersurface, which is like on top of this one, and I keep going on another and another and another. So that's how people go to that. So it's called covering space. So people go to covering space. And that's one solution how to avoid these closed timeline curves. Yes?
Couldn't you do the same for like n minus 2, 2 signature?
Maybe you could. I haven't thought about it. Maybe you could. Okay. So now we studied the most interesting maximally symmetric spaces, but I still haven't explained to you why really they are called maximally symmetric. So let me just make a few words about why maximally symmetric. This is not good. Why maximally symmetric? So you know that symmetries in GR, they are described by Killing vectors, right? So Killing vector is a special direction in your spacetime, which tells you, well, if I move along that direction, my geometry does not change. Okay, so symmetries. These correspond to Killing vectors. And you must have derived somewhere in one of the courses is that if I want a Killing vector psi A, then it has to satisfy Killing vector equation. Nabla A psi B plus nabla B psi A equals to 0. So let's say Killing equation. So now interesting question is, how many Killing vectors I can find in space, in any spacetime, right? So for that, or for given spacetime, whenever you have like partial differential equation, people study integrability conditions. So they basically study under which circumstances I can find a solution of this equation. So study integrability conditions. And so integrability conditions is that basically people usually differentiate the equation which they have, and then they, in order this to have solution that if you swap derivatives, let's say partial derivatives, then this should work. Like swapping partial derivatives should work, and so on. So similarly, I will study like another. So I will differentiate this equation once, and then I will apply the Riemann identity. Okay, so maybe let me start with the Riemann identity. So what you need to do is that you take nabla C, nabla B, psi A. And then if you swap these two derivatives, so if you want to write this is equal to nabla B, nabla C, and psi A, then you pick up the Riemann tensor. It's plus R CBA, I hope. And then there is a D psi D. Okay, so this is just the Riemann identity, basic definition of the Riemann tensor. Okay, so now people, what they do is that they cyclically permutate all these indices. So we have CBA, and people write the similar equation for ACB and also for BAC. Okay, and then you take some equations plus and some equations minus. I think it should be plus, minus, and plus, I hope. Doesn't matter. And then at some point, you want to use your Killing equation. So for example, due to Killing equation, I can swap these two indices, right? Just picking up a minus sign, right? So I can write this guy as nabla B, nabla C, nabla a psi c, and so on. So if you do that, so add these three equations, use the Killing equation, also use the cyclic identity for the Riemann tensor. So you know if you cyclically add these three things, you get zero, right? So it's your homework if you want. So in the end, what you get from here is that nabla a, nabla b, psi c equals to minus R, B, C, A, D, psi D. So it's really the cyclic permutation plus Riemann identity plus Killing equation. Right? And this is what you get. So this is amazing equation, and I'll just tell you two consequences of this equation. So one consequence, which actually, so consequence one, is due to Walt, the famous general relativist, and you know he was just playing with these things, and what he realized, well, let's contract the indices A and B. So A and B, if you contract. And what you get is that box on psi c, and here I get a Ricci tensor. It's equal to minus r cd psi d. Okay? So in particular, if I am in vacuum, so vacuum is equal to zero. Okay? Well, at the same time, due to this equation, if I contract A and B, well, these two terms are the same, and I have the divergence of psi is equal to zero. So you have, at the same time, that nabla A psi A equals to zero. You recognize these two equations, box on psi equals to zero, and divergence of psi equals to zero. So this guy is the Lorentz gauge, and this is the Maxwell equation. So if I identify A, the electromagnetic potential, with a Killing vector psi, then I get automatically a solution of Maxwell equations. And so Walt really used this trick to basically put black holes in magnetic fields and so on. So really, if you have a spacetime which admits some Killing vectors, you get immediately solutions of Maxwell equations for free. And so this is one of the things he's famous for. It's very simple, right? Very simple, but that's how we become famous for these things. Okay, so that's consequence one. Consequence two is that actually Killing field is completely determined if you take a point in your spacetime and you just specify the values of the Killing field there and the values of its derivatives there, then everything is already determined. The field is determined everywhere in the spacetime. So this is highly non-trivial because if you think about Taylor's theorem, like Taylor's expansion, then in order to know how my field looks very, very far away from one point, I need to know all the derivatives. Right? I need to know the value and the first derivative, second derivative, and so on. So if you have Killing field, you need to know only the first derivative. Okay, so Killing field completely determined by values psi A and LAB, which is nabla A psi B, at one point on the manifold. And so I don't really want to go into the proof, but it's basically what you are having here. So if I start at a point P, and I want to know how my field looks at a point Q, I just make any curve which connects these two points. And so this curve will have some tangent vector VB. And then you just rewrite the equations which you already have, so the integrability condition, in terms of these fields L and psi. So what you have, so you parallel transport your things along that curve. So you have VA, nabla A, psi B. And so by definition, so this is just LAB. So this is equal to VA LAB. Okay, so that's one equation. And the other equation is the integrability condition. So VA nabla A LBC equals to minus RBC. What is this? Doesn't matter. AD, PsiD, VA. So that's the other equation, this one there. So now you have two partial differential equations, which are linear, and so we are solving for psi and L anywhere here. And they have always a solution. So there's always a unique solution to these equations. So really, I can always basically find these values or the field at any point Q, because I can always solve these equations just from the theory of partial differential equations. So what it means is that on a manifold, there is only a limited number of Killing vectors, right? And that number corresponds to how many of these and how many of those, right? So on a manifold of dimension n, so there is n values of these because it's a vector. I have n of those. And these guys, by Killing equation, they are antisymmetric, right? So the derivative is actually antisymmetric. The symmetric part vanishes. So these guys are antisymmetric. So there is n over 2 of those. So you have, at most, n times n plus 1 over 2 Killing vectors. On any manifold. And of course, if you want, so for example, in Minkowski space or in Euclidean space, this would be like n translations, and there will be this number of rotations if you want. So this is the maximum number which you can ever get of Killing vectors on any manifold. Okay. And then again, it will be your task, hopefully, in one of the tutorials, to construct these Killing vectors for an arbitrary metric there. Okay, so see tutorial, hopefully, probably tutorial 2. Okay, so where you explicitly actually can write down all these Killing vectors on arbitrary maximally symmetric space. So this was all very fancy, so let me just conclude with how we could see this much more easily. So note that so this is our definition of our maximally symmetric spaces. So we have this d square equals to eta ab dxa dxb, and we have this constraint k rho square equals to eta ab xa and xb. So now you're asking, is there any symmetry to these equations? What can I do with my axis so that actually the equations look the same? And basically, you can do something like a Lorentz transformation or rotation if you want. Okay, so. So our defining equations are invariant invariant under xa tilde equals to something like a Lorentz transformation lambda ab xb. And of course, they will be invariant as long as I don't change the metric, really, as long as ts squared remains the same. So where? Eta AB, and that's the condition for that. PQ and K equals to eta CD is the family condition, but now just looks more fancy because it has this PQ and K in it. But otherwise, it's very much familiar to you. Lambda C and A and lambda D and B. So as long as this is true, then I can make these coordinate transformations, and my equations will look exactly the same. Okay. So now, that means that basically I have a group, something like a Poincaré group or not Poincaré group. Anyway, so these matrices form a group which is O P plus K plus 1 over 2 and Q plus 1 minus K over 2. So that's the group of your symmetry. And you know, as always, you can write lambda AB infinitesimally, so it's like 1 delta AB plus small lambda A and B. And then if you lower the index by your metric, you find out that lambda AB with both indices down is antisymmetric. So this is eta AC lambda CB. P, Q, and K. So it's something very, very familiar for you. We just have this P, Q, and K now. So this guy is antisymmetric, which means, this guy lives in n plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so how many components it has? It has n plus 1 over 2. It's antisymmetric, but it's in n plus 1 dimensions. So this is n times n plus 1 over 2, and that's the maximum number of Killing vectors you have. Okay. Questions? So this was all about maximal symmetric spaces. You will find this them a little bit more on tutorial, maybe in homework. But we'll just use all this thing in a special case tomorrow when we will be constructing Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space.
So maximally symmetric can be defined as having the maximum number of Killing vectors.
Exactly.
How do we know these are all of them?
I haven't proved that. I haven't proved that. Yeah, but they are. They are. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, well, see you tomorrow then.